It's Friday, April 14th, 2017 at 3:32. And my name is Julia Hallaby. I teach at Boulder High School and I'm a Palestinian American. And I am really happy to be your moderator for this panel. So I would like to go ahead and introduce our panelists in the order that they'll be speaking. Can you still hear me?
Yes.
Are you guys ready for bellowing?
Ooh.
Hopefully we will have a mic soon. Please signal us if you need better audibility while we wait for this, okay? Our first speaker today will be Maurizio Geri.
Good accent.
He is a mystic, a Florentine and human-centered individual. He is also a Conference on World Affairs virgin. Not quite, because it's his fifth day, but
same finance.
First year. So I always like to say hooray for joining. Next to speak is Janet Breslin-Smith, 5+ years in Saudi Arabia.
No, 4+ years.
Almost 5 years in Saudi Arabia. Has a lot of personal reflection and fascinating observations from her time to share with us. And is a Conference on World Affairs 9th year veteran, which I feel connected to because it's my 9th year moderating, so.
And a CU mom.
Oh, and a CU mom, yes, that's right. And third to speak will be Shadia Marhaban, who is a 2nd year Conference on World Affairs presenter, and we're so happy to have her here all the way from Indonesia. Her greatest hope is to help instill hope in the youth of Muslims today. And I think that they all have put a lot of thought into this and have some really great things to say. So we will start with about 10 minutes each, and then we'll do some talk back and forth, and then we'll do questions. As the fifth day, you've probably already heard this a number of times, but this session will utilize a note card system for questions. My producer, Jim, is probably trying to attend to the microphone issue, but if you'll raise a hand, he'll see you and get
to
you.
He's got the note.
I'm not sure, or you have some. Okay.
Cards.
All right, so raise a hand for cards.
We haven't said anything yet.
Carla. Very good.
Now I know the panel. I'm going to ask questions.
Very good.
If you're
we
a student,
you.
Please put an S or something so that I know and I can give your questions priority. And without further ado, I think we'll get started. Is that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
No microphone? Okay.
We'll just speak
I will try my voice, Italian style. Strong voice. So among the things that I've been doing, you know, there is one thing that I've been just finishing to work with NATO, North Atlantic Treaty Organization. I was a strategic foresight analyst. We studied the next 20, 25 years. Among the other things that we studied is that Muslim religion in the world will become 3 billion people in the next 50 years. More or less the same number of Christianity. So better we study a little bit more deeper this religion and this culture to deal with the future relationships in the world. I'm going to talk a little bit generally. I will do some kind of introduction because here we have people more expert coming from actually that faith and that places where the faith is majority. I will have a little bit of, hopefully not too much orientalistic view, but a little bit of analysis as much as possible objective. So I will talk about geographical, historical, and cultural dimensions of Islam. More than divergences, I will talk about dimensions. I like the word dimensions because dimensions open space for deep analysis. Regarding the geographical dimension of Islam, obviously we know that it born in Saudi Arabia, or at least in the Peninsula Arabica, as a religion, but also as a political expression with the government. And similar to Christianity, expanded through the political elements, because in Christianity we had the Roman Empire, and in Islam they had the Caliphate. But as soon as it expanded in the world, it became divided in many types of sects, like in Christianity, in many types of groups. And so we cannot think about Islam as a monolith, and neither as a dual system of Shia and Sunni. We go from Malakite system in Tunisia, we go from north, the corn of Africa, that are Shafi, we go to Indonesia, that are more non-denominational. Now, in Asia, in Central Asia, Kazakhstan, in the Balkans, in Indonesia, in India, Muslims define themselves as non-denominational. This is very important. They define themselves as Muslim, not as a particular sect. So this, again, opens space for inclusiveness, for understanding of pluralism, because you don't identify yourself as a small group. But popular Islam in many countries, like in Turkey or in Iran, is also related with spirituality a lot, with Sufism. For example, there is the veneration of saints that we have in Christianity, they have also in Islam. In countries like Turkey, Iran in particular, as I said, that are non-Arabic, as students here probably have studied history, geography, and cultures. Turkey is a non-Arab country, Iran is a non-Arab country, and I repeat, the majority of the Muslim people live in non-Arab countries. We have 300 million in India, we have almost 300 million in Indonesia, 200 million in Bangladesh, Pakistan. So Asian Islam is an important feature for the future, and later my colleagues will speak about that. The narrative that this Islam can bring to the world, in particular to the Middle East, the sectarian sometimes manipulation of the politicians of this religion, can help in the future of the stability of the region. But regarding historical dimensions of Islam, not only geographical dimension, as I said, it started as a political expression also, like in Christianity we had an empire, in the Middle East they had the Caliphate, and the Caliphate changed in the times, in the centuries, until it arrived to the Ottoman Empire, the Ottoman Caliphate. And they changed the relationship they had and the structure of the societies. In the Ottoman Caliphate, for example, they had the millet system. Here we have someone speaking in Arabic. The millet system, millet means nation in Arabic. But the nations at those times were the people of the book. The Jewish, the Christian, and the Muslim, they were considered as identities. Then suddenly the Roman, European imperialist power arrived. They destroyed the Ottoman Empire after First World War, and we create the mono-ethnic nation state with colonies, with states that are supported by external powers. So we destroyed that vision of identity based on faith, and we go with identity based on ethnic groups. We call it in the Roman Empire divide and conquer, divide and impera, divide and rule. This is very important to understand when we talk about political Islam, because the political expression of Islam born because of these colonial times. In at the end of the Ottoman Empire, we had the Shadi will talk more about this, Al-Banna, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood. We had the independence movements in the Middle East coming as a Muslim reaction to the non-Muslim imperial powers that were dominating the region. So again, there is a political expression of the religion as a freedom, self-determination. And it starts with the development of the so-called Islamism or political Islam. But political Islam, again, is very different, because you have the Wahhabism system in Saudi Arabia that is a very radical, a very sometimes extremist vision of political Islam that has been recuperated actually by ISIS, because ISIS is not dogmatically very different from Saudi Arabia. And this is open a lot of questions about how we relate with this country, but is another topic, another panel we spoke already. But there is also other type of political Islam. Muslim Brotherhood, one part of Muslim Brotherhood is called Ennahda. It's a party in Tunisia that is very moderate. Thank you. Now I'll scream less. It's very moderate and has been very useful for the passage of democratization process after the Arab Spring, because in Tunisia, Ennahda was very inclusive, also for women's rights, also for pluralistic visions of the institutions. So we see that, and then you have the political Islam of Asia, and Indonesia, for example, have been working, Shade will talk more about that. You have Nahdlatul Ulama, you have Muhammadiyah, gigantic association, social associations. They do political activism, they do social activism, hospitals, schools, they intervene in the societies, and so they don't need political parties that appeal to this support to the populations, because already the social organizations of this Muhammadiyah is facing the needs of the population. So also political Islam has been very many expressions, so there is not one monolithic view. But I will finish very quickly about the cultural dimension, in the sense that, as I said, I don't want to be too much orientalist, ethnocentric, but here, you know, last year you had the pin of the map of the world from the North Pole, because you want to go to NASA wants to go to Mars, but from outside in the space, the planet Earth doesn't have west and east, north and south. So I suggest that we don't talk all the time Middle East. We can say Southwest Asia, for example. This is changing your perspective geographically, but also culturally, because as we see the maps, is also how we build the thinking, the thoughts. So I suggest, particularly as Europeans, now when the immigrants come from the Arab world, we don't say only Middle East. We, in the past, the Roman Empire, we call it the Mediterranean, is the sea between the lands, means Mediterranean. I suggested to my government, the mayor of Florence now is prime minister in Florence. He said, besides the rail integration in Europe through the rail, the train, with the train tickets, we should do the inter-sail. It means the sailing between north part of Mediterranean and south part of Mediterranean to learn and exchange students. Learn Arabic language. I don't speak, but I tried in the mosque in a couple of. I mean, we don't have mosque, unfortunately, in Florence. They have to pray in the garage, but that's another problem. We have to integrate the immigrants through also the rights of having their own possibility to pray at their time, eat the halal food in the public school. In this way, there will be less problems of radicalization. So, again, the cultural approach between so-called West and the rest, or the northern Mediterranean, the southern Mediterranean, has to a little bit shifting the chip in the mind, think about geography in a different way, not dominating one part on the other, and then we will open space for convergence and collaboration. Thank you.
And you're going to have to stop.
Okay. I'll wave it too. Give you a warning.
Thanks. Well, thanks. Thanks, everyone. I guess what I want to do is share with you my observations. I'm not Muslim. I did not study Middle Eastern politics when I was in grad school. And when I taught at the National War College and I was the department chair, I had the opportunity to teach a geostrategic class, and I never wanted to teach the Middle East. It was, or what am I going to call it?
Southwest Asia.
Or whatever. The between the continents. It was too complicated, too passionate, too hard. I had lived in Asia and in Latin America. And so then all of a sudden one day, fate has it, my husband became ambassador to Saudi Arabia. And the way I approached this, I knew it was a unique opportunity and a privilege, obviously, to have this experience. I had taught Saudi officers at our National War College. We have an exchange program, and also officers from Indonesia and Pakistan, across the world. But I was teaching specifically, strategic planning and things like that. And so when Jim told me we were going to be going to Riyadh, I don't think I brought prejudice or preconceptions with me. I knew I had this opportunity to listen. There had been no wife before me. There were bombings in 2005 and 6, and so families were evacuated for the whole, the diplomatic community, but certainly our embassy. So ambassadors had a 1-year, 2-year unaccompanied assignment. So when I got there, as I thought about it on the plane, I started reading, but I thought, could I get to the point where I would look at life through a Saudi woman's eyes. And that was my goal. And in all honesty, I only did it one night for 15 minutes. It's hard. It's always hard to be in another culture. When I lived in Japan, and I grew up in a Japanese-American community in California, but another culture makes you appreciate another culture and also reflect on your own, because you're looking at the contrast. And certainly living in Saudi Arabia forced me to do that, because it's the only country I've ever been in where the culture pushes back on you so hard. You cannot get off an airplane in Saudi Arabia as a woman without dressing with an abaya itself. I could go to Japan, I could go to China, I could go to Indonesia, and no one is going to expect me to dress in the national religiously observant dress. So when I got there, I remember thinking, okay, this is a culture, it's challenging the assumptions I make, not just about geostrategic issues, but about life itself. And so in the year, those first 2 or 3 years I was there, I had this unique opportunity just to talk, listen, watch how children were raised, how young women talked to each other about their hopes and aspirations, and how women my age were dealing with the change. Over and over again, almost every day we were there. And again, I should say, Riyadh looks like Phoenix. It's modern, high-rise, freeways. And so one book about Saudi Arabia makes the reference to this, that if your eye gazes up, you feel you could be in any urban center. As your eyes gaze down and you look at the human level of life, you're in a very different time frame. Because if you look at pictures of Saudi Arabia from 100, 200, 300, 500 years ago, the dress and in some respects the style of life in the social context really hasn't changed. And so as an outsider coming in, I can't think of any other experience like this, the juxtaposition of modern and traditional. And so almost every day I had this sense, if anybody has an iPhone near them, give it to me. Thank you, Graham, that'll work. I had this sense of tidal waves washing over the country. So some days the tidal wave of globalization would wash over. A new thing would happen on YouTube, so that's why I'm making reference to this, because this, all the kids watch YouTube. The new comedian in Long Beach, California, Fluffy, those of you who are young know who Fluffy is, the number one comedian for a brief moment of time among high school kids in Saudi Arabia, because of YouTube. So some days I would feel this wave of global influence wash over the country, and then somebody would, some woman, would start to say, I would like to start a driving movement again. And they would YouTube themselves driving through Riyadh at night. And they would give, and they send me the YouTube. And then a few days later, the clerics and the religious leadership would issue a strong condemnation of whatever this is, the YouTube video or the woman driving or whatever it was. And I would have this sense of another wave washing over the country, pushing back, trying to hold, control, keep change from happening. It was exhausting watching this, because you could feel a society that is extremely controlled, fearful of change, getting out of control, and yet not being able to protect themselves against it, because it's the highest Twitter use in the world. In Saudi Arabia.
Twitter.
The participation in Twitter, being on social media, using Twitter, WhatsApp, I mean, I could go on, I'm too old to know all these things, but WhatsApp, all the social media, Uber is gigantic, so the girls can, you know, arrange a ride to go to a restaurant. The country's engaged electronically. I'll just take a few other observations. Again, I could talk about it forever. It was the most fascinating thing I've ever done. Fascinating and confounding thing I ever did. One confounding issue that made me rethink us. I love Western values. I worked in our Congress. I was raised in this country. To me, how could you question those? Freedom, individualism, liberty. I got there, and the first editorial I read was, "We have to protect ourselves against the evil of Western values." And I started talking to my friends, "Explain this to me. I'm missing something." And they said, "The United States, such a cold and harsh place. So selfish." I said, "What do you mean?" "Assisted care facilities." It caught my eye. Yes, indeed, I have to say. In almost all the world, and certainly in Saudi, families stay together. You take care of your elders within your family. The harshness and the coldness and selfishness of us constructing these communities someplace and put the grandparents there. And again, as I am my grandmother, I'm watching out. Somebody can push me there. And I began then to reevaluate myself to say, this is a, I got this. That this culture, which has different values than ours, is at a point though of crisis where the globalization pressures and the pressures to stay, in other words, the idea that globalization solutions are the answer versus Islam is the answer, is in conflict right now. So my notion of this, my takeaway is, our premise to understand this issue should change from the idea that it is the West versus Islam or vice versa. But what we're watching right now, we happen to be alive right now at a moment of extreme pressure, internal discussion and struggle within, and it's individually played out in a different way within every nation of the world, which is a majority Muslim nation. So I want to leave you with that. Can we change the premise of our understanding from us versus them to a support of them as they contend with these issues themselves? Thanks.
Hello, good afternoon. I guess I'm the last one.
And the Muslim
for all the pressures on me. But yeah, I think as Maurizio and also
Julie,
Janet already mentioned about that, Islam is very diverse. If we talk about Muslim, currently we have about 1.6 billion Muslim living in this planet, and Muslim travel originally from the Middle East and travel all the way to China, to India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and of course my own country, Indonesia, Malaysia, Brunei, and some parts of Thailand. So it is a big community if we want to generalize it in one basket, if we want to put them in one basket. I would say, not possible. Islam is not a monolithic phenomenon, but a complex concept with multifaceted distinction. And I think this is because the topic is about geopolitics, so geopolitics means that we, a different region in the world that have Muslim community, are culturally diverse. And many Muslims, for example, in China, Uyghur are originally Turks. Why they are there? Because of the Silk Road. Mm. Why they are a Silk Road? Because they are trade. So you have to trace all the way back in order to understand why this changes. The second thing is also my own country, Indonesia. I mean, Maurizio already touched a bit about the function of the constitution is a secular constitution in my country, but it's the most largest Muslim country in the world. It's not in Saudi Arabia, but it's in Indonesia. We have about six different religions protected by the constitution. A quite diverse and democratic country, one of the most democratic countries in Southeast Asia, and also very plural society. So one cannot say that Islam are not accepting or embracing democracy. Islam is very compatible with democracy. However, the process to go to that level is varies from one country to another. So in the United States, mostly, the knowledge about Islam is because what we saw on TV or what we read on the news about the Middle East, the Sunni and Shiites, the fights, the proxy war. But I would like to take a deeper look on the other Islamic values. You know, Islam lives in the East. Islam lives in Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand. Even some of Islam also in Cambodia and Vietnam. These are traders. These are traders who came ages ago through trade and intermarriages, and they converge together, built city together. So these are happening because of the trade routes, you know, from the South China Sea to the Indian Ocean and so forth. When Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, left Mecca due to the pressure that he was given by the outrageous attack against him, you know, he can't even preach, or they want to threaten to kill him. Prophet Muhammad then left to Medina. And in Medina, he established what we call the Medina Charter or Medina Constitution. And this constitution actually shows how diverse Islam when it was born. Because in Medina, there are two communities living, the Arabs and the Jews. And the Jews, those days, are allowed to plow the fields, work, and also exercising their political aspiration. There are no differences whatsoever in the name of, you know, difference as we understand of today. They experienced a great moment of life in Medina. And many of us, even Muslim scholars, often forgot about this, you know, how diverse we are, how acceptant we are to the different culture and community. And remember, we're talking about the Abraham Pact. We're talking about the people of the book, the Christian, the Jews, and the Muslim. However, distorted come after, you know, like Maurizio also said, there is this distortion of imperialism, you know, after the war. We're talking about the rise of resistance, Islam political resistance, after the colonialism, say for example in Francophone countries such as in Algeria, Tunisia, and so on. So this resistance came. I mean, someone like Jamaluddin al-Afghani, for example, you should read his piece, you know. And also, we talk about the Pakistan, for example, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, or even Ali Shariati, you know, of Iran. These are the thinker, but it doesn't necessarily trying to destroy West. You know, it is not about destroying the West. It is not about the clash of civilization. It is about coexistence. But of course, it's complicated to live in a situation where the mass media pointing Muslim as terrorist, for example, putting Muslim in that category. It's even harder for Muslim to promote Islam in a way where people can understand us. And I think the role of mass media is very important, very critical, and many of us are driven by what we see on the news, what happened in Gaza, what happened in Syria, and we were really caught up by day to day, and all we see is violence. We don't see that peace-loving, peace-builders from Indonesia, mostly women, who are working and trying to build peace with Christian community or with Hindu community in India. There are many people who are working, you know, really risking their life for peace. And we don't often get this kind of news. We often only see the violent narratives, the negativity of how Islam is being seen, you know, by the Western world. So I think these narratives should change. And remember, the hope is also big for Islam, because you think about 1.6 billion and this number will rise. India now have about 300 Muslim, Indonesia 220 Muslim. They are non-Arabs. And these are the future of Islam. Because these people can really bring the trade back, can really bring peace through trade. Why I said that? Because if you look at the economic improvement this country has been made, for example, Malaysia, the GDP is high. Singapore, it's almost like Switzerland. I mean, we have other countries. I mean, Indonesia is still poor, but it's the entrepreneurial ship in Indonesia is very high. So there's a lot of women devoting their life in businesses, creating fashion, hijab, you know, design, for example. I mean, recently even I read Nike is already producing a hijab. Sports for athletes, you know. Yeah. That's kind of taking all the women in Indonesia, poor women in Indonesia, they're working, trying to design a burkini that is it's sort of a
modest.
So yeah. I mean, I still can't believe what happened in France when these people are being kicked out of the pitch. But whatever happens, I think it's just not maybe not applicable to their norms. But you have Nike and you have Dolce & Gabbana recently also designing abaya, you know. And you have Gianni Versace also. So they realize the market of this future generation. And these are young, progressive, hippie Muslims who dress like me, roaming around in the streets of Doha with their Ferrari and in Jakarta and Singapore. These are the future of Islam. So actually there is no fear. These generations are listening to, you know, Western songs, educated at Harvard, in Yale, Georgetown. Many of my Indonesian friends in Saudi, for sure, you know, gaining knowledge from the United States and Europe. So these are the future of Islam. So I think the coexistence will happen again at one point through trade. And let us dream this together. So I think the future should be seeing not with the eyes of a fish, but look with the eyes of a bird. Thank you.
Engage here.
Sure.
Because here's the political puzzle in this. How many people in Indonesia?
220 million.
220 million. How many people in Saudi? 20. Saudis. Okay, so let's think this through together in terms of just a practical, political, philosophical challenge. Saudi Arabia is the home of the two holy mosques, the two holy places. The King Salman is the custodian, he's referred to as the custodian of the two holy places. Mm. As you mentioned, the world of Islam is almost 1.6 billion. So 20 million people in the intellectual religious center and of people who perceive of themselves as setting the standard from their own point of view. That when you go to Saudi, Saudis never use the word Wahhabi. They never talk about different approaches. They are Islam, and Islam is life, and that is the way that's practiced in Saudi Arabia. So to me, the challenge that we're hearing right here in this panel is, and if I had a dream, it would be, could the Asian practice, could Malaysia, could Indonesia step up to the intellectual plate right now and take on this issue, because it's not being addressed specifically within the land of the two holy mosques. We know, I can say as an American, my view of this is that the religion itself, I will say this, and the culture certainly in the Gulf is in crisis. Syria is a nation that epitomizes to me the lack of political ability within the region. Saudi Arabia is not poor, to come in and not only take control of the destiny of that region, but intellectually provide the political foundation for the most basic question in humankind, which is how do groups deal with each other, different groups. So I want to leave you with that dilemma. From my eyes, the dilemma, you represent the hope in the future, but the struggle is the birthplace thought.
Yes, me too, I will add. Yes, good point, 20 million. And here it comes Europe and the so-called West. Who is supporting that 20 million? Because where is going the money, the support, the political legitimacy, if we, as European Union and United States, we start to shift a little bit towards the East, the real East, the Asia, not only the Southwest Asia, the Southeast Asia, the East Asia, India, 300 million.
You mean look to them?
Yes, because you say you can empower by themselves, yes, but who paid for the petrol dollars paid for the madrasas of Wahhabi all around the Middle East, right? So it's also a question of foreign policy. Second thing I want to say is, when you said about tradition and modernity, very good point, because Habermas speaks about post-secular societies. It's not only here that there is this individualism or lack of belonging, lack of spirituality, it's in Northern Europe, in Europe. So we talk about post-secular societies because we can learn from Islam or other religions or even Hindu, their relationships with their own connections, spiritual at the individual level, but also at the community level. Because our elders, they go also alone in these houses when they are old. So we can, many other things we can learn if we start the convergence, not only the spiritual values. In Berlin, they are building the Temple of One. There is one entrance and three exits, because the Abrahamic faith are the same God. And in Nebraska, there is the three-faith temple, also synagogue, mosque, and church together, in the same place, like in Iran. In Iran, they had also that for centuries of years, for centuries. So that's how we, as a foreign policy, as a so-called North global, or whatever you want to define, we can impact this convergence. Okay, that's my point.
Thank you.
But well,
go ahead. We have some more time.
One just quick, and then. Yeah. But as an example of how hard this is, the Saudis, especially when King Abdullah was alive, he passed on 2 years ago. But while in his era, he was responding to this and said, "I will put Saudi Arabia will put money into an interfaith dialogue center." He put it in Vienna.
Because the
Well, there are no,
it's true, yeah.
Riyadh would be a lovely place to put it.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
Or Mecca, or Medina, or Jeddah, or Dahran. Mm-hmm. Saudi Arabia is a sophisticated, globally oriented country with a very traditional foundation. The debate, it would be interesting if the debate, the struggling with issues, all nations, all of us, are struggling with profound questions right now. Nuclear weapons, biological things. I'm too old to think about some of these things. Mm-hmm. We could use some both spiritual and ethical help in struggling through a cloning of people. I mean, there's tons of issues. Social justice. Islam has a value of social justice. The Pope has spoken about social justice. Mm-hmm. Now, Islam does not have the same hierarchical order, but I just leave that the Center for Interfaith Dialogue is in Vienna.
Yeah.
Thank you for bringing that up, Janet, because it's Kaisi, yeah, King Khalid, one of the millions of dollars funding that have been thrown into the dialogue, but unfortunately it is in Vienna. And the problem, I think, with what you have said earlier, why Southeast Asia did not appear, it's because also the United States are reluctant to make us emerge. The reluctance by the United States, because there is not much interest in Southeast Asia as they have in the Middle East. That is the reason why the Southeast Asian Muslim, or so-called South Asian Muslim, are not very much on the top of the world discussion on Islam. The second thing is Arabic is not our language. Mm. So that's also putting us in another position where we are not Arabs, non-Arabs, therefore you don't speak Arabic, so you literally don't know Quran very well, well, I tell you, I can read Quran, maybe don't understand, I read the translation, but I can read Arabic just like the Saudi women. So the thing is, when foreign government, you know, in particular, I'm talking about European Union and also the United States, the measurement many Muslim countries are using is post 9/11. That is the measurement. The second thing is also the Israel-Palestine conflict. That is very much so close to the heart of the Jewish people and also to the Muslim. And it somehow create more and more problem, because as if we don't talk to each other, because we don't talk to each other. That is makes this situation even complex. But I would say the Islam in Southeast Asia can contribute a lot, actually, not only through publication, but also through dialogue, open space. But we are not seen, we are invisible. One professor told me that Indonesia is almost like a ghost country, because it's so invisible. How come 260 million population with a very diverse community, we have about 350 languages, and very hundreds of ethnic groups. I grew up with three languages myself. And then I added English. So when I was seven, I had already spoken four languages. Isn't that amazing? But we are not seen. This invisible position of Indonesia, Malaysia, and all countries in Southeast Asia should change. And I think the United States and the EU should also think differently. Not only because we are no longer the country that needed IMF or International Monetary Fund. We are no longer begging for development, you know. World Bank, it's just there to because they have to be there. We are now developing. We are not rich, but we are developing with thousands of entrepreneurs. When young people graduate from college, they don't think about, oh, I want to get a job in this company or that company. But they're thinking, how can I start my business? How can I put 200 people into work? That is the attitude of young Indonesians. And I really need the support of all of you.
Yes. Yes, Janet, very important what you said. So how we go for there? We go looking at other cases. For example, there is another monarchy in North Africa that is Morocco. And after the Arab Spring, after the revolution, the king started to reform. It's not the best, but he started very good to reform. Here in Saudi we have the ownership of a country since 250 years when Al Saud did the agreement with Wahhabi. Mm-hmm. And we, as political legitimacy, economic support, we are maintaining that power. And there is also inside, obviously, the Arabic, the advantage of having Mecca and Medina. Yes, there are domestic issues, but there are also international issues, and we can support the moderate form of political Islam in Tunisia, Morocco, Turkey, we'll see, and see how we can open space for others to enter in this narrative. Thank you. Yes, let's go with the questions.
Yeah, we have a lot of
questions.
A lot, and I thought I could maybe lump them together. I think it would be good. I'm going to start with some student questions. Can you discuss? And actually, for the sake of getting more questions answered, would you like each volunteer for one? And
yes,
we'll,
sure.
Okay, so for this. Can you discuss the Arab Spring movement of 2011 and the aftermath of those events? Who wants to take that question?
Yeah, I can say something, yes. So I already started a little bit. As I said, Tunisia had success and Morocco in part because of two main reasons. One is the level of inclusiveness of the country at economic and political level. They created a relationship with the moderate political Islam, the Ennahda party in Tunisia, and the secular party. So when you have an inclusion of the different parts of the societies, more secular and the more pious, then you have success. AKP in Turkey is the more pious people, more religious people respect to the nationalist party that for decades they rule Turkey. When you are winners take it all, the tyranny of the majority on the minority, or the majority in theory, because it's the electoral majority, is not the population majority, that's the risk of failing. Monarchy, again, as I said, in Morocco, they are reforming. They are reforming also in Saudi Arabia, but very, very small. I think the women started to vote for local elections. But not to, so it takes long time. But this can be also pushed a little bit from outside. You know, European Union was pushing Turkey to go a little bit faster with the inclusion of the Kurds, cultural rights. So that's the role. Arab Spring has a lot of, you know, the ethnic minorities has been always the Achilles heel of the Middle East. But we can, as external forces, because we are the one that's selling either the weapons in one side or the money for economic development. We can, with lobby and advocacy, push towards one direction or in another. So that's what we had to do.
I just want to make a quick comment. We were in Riyadh when Tahrir Square happened. We watched it 24/7. Two things occurred to me. It was a spontaneous, amazing, historic response without a charismatic leader. So I mean, it was a spontaneous thing. And then as I watched it day after day after day, as time went on, it touches this thing I'm trying to reason through, that yes, they achieved Mubarak left, but no other political philosophy and approach came to mind, because it hadn't been, there hadn't been a loud enough conversation to get thoughts together, maybe a combination in life of elections and selection. There's a lot of ways to do politics. But because that hadn't happened, the existing structure that existed with the Muslim Brotherhood was organized. But the idea, it touched something. And in Saudi, it was terror. Because if this could happen, chaos breaks out, which reinforces a feeling, especially in the Gulf, that from their point of view, the history of Islam is a history of authority, order, both order in the faith keeps you in the it promoting virtue and prohibiting vice, and the political structure is order from the top to the bottom. When that's disrupted, there is this deep fear, and they look at Syria and say, look, if you don't have order, you have chaos, anarchy, and misery. So that is what is on the plate. And to me, aside from the US role in this or European role, my instinct tells me this is the moment for her to shine. This is the moment. It's not the US, it's not the EU, this is your moment.
Thank you. I think that's a great segue for Shadia. How can Muslim youth and Muslim Americans from all over the Muslim world help break negative stereotypes and help bring about cultural understanding?
I've always believed in the exposure, exchange studies for American in their youth, and also for Muslims from Southeast Asia to travel to Western countries and to learn from each other. Because I think we don't use a lot of our capacity for dialogue. We use a lot for prejudice and putting stigma and hate speech, not in Boulder, but I'm talking in another place. And I would really encourage the opposite, you know, building bridges, building dialogue with Muslim communities that are non-Arabs, for example, you know, Turkey, you know, even Pakistan, India, China. We forgot there are Muslim also in China. Oh yeah. There are Uyghur in China. There are Hui ethnic group in China, and their numbers, according to Chinese census, is about 30 million, but I believe it is more than 30 million, because the Uyghur never been really participating in the census. So we could use some of this dialogue and working together. You wouldn't believe if I said in Indonesia, part of the groups that I'm attending and meetings with are mostly run by different faith students. You know, they're trying to organize and building bridges and make one understand to the simple explanation of why am I wearing hijab and why some other Muslim are not. Because in Indonesia, you can choose, you can wear, or you can just be open like here. You know, it's not a mandatory. But we open this space also for questions. What happened in the Middle East is that the culture, they are originally, you know, in particular Saudi Arabia, they are originally tribes. You know, if you look at since the Prophet Muhammad time, these tribes really, they don't change very much, except now they're getting rich. They don't change very much in terms of style. Well, intellectually, maybe they're now educated at Georgetown, Yale, Princeton, and Harvard. But the lifestyle, I mean, the understanding is still the same, you know? So what we need is to understand also the other side of the world, which is more reconciliatory, more forgiveness culture in the community, more restorative justice is being built in my part of the world. So there's so much to learn for young Americans to travel to Southeast Asia.
And again, just a quick note, Saudi Arabia does not allow tourism. So everything you just said is obviously true. Exchange and dialogue is the key here. But Saudis don't want to take the chance. And one man told me as well, people will come here and they'll drink whiskey and wear bikinis. Does Riyadh come to mind? If you want to wear your bikini and drink whiskey, I don't know. Or I said, make tourism for over 60. But that, I mean, I'm making light of this. They have been talking about tourism as long as I can think. They build a new hotel, but they don't want to take a chance on exactly what she's talking about. They don't want to have it open.
That's a good segue. I would like to direct the next question at you. There are a number of questions, Janet, for clarity on your 15 minutes of seeing through the eyes of a Muslim.
Yeah. It was a dinner, actually, it's interesting. It was a dinner one night with some friends of mine who are women professors that are there. Every single thing in Saudi Arabia is gender separated. There is no mixed. So women at a women's university, and we were talking actually about Palestine, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And I was listening to their conversation. It was going back and forth between Arabic and English. And again, I'm struggling with my Arabic. But for a brief moment, I could follow their line of thinking, and I could see, and I could put my brain where they were in their perspective on it. It only lasted 15 minutes because I kept, with my brain, my Western brain, I kept looking for solutions. You know, I'm a Norwegian-German person, and I was raised to, there's a problem, let's get together and look for a solution. And that's where I still am on this question. I want to hand over, I'm gonna make her in charge. it's such a complex cultural question here of the colonial experience, especially for North Africa and parts of the Mediterranean area, over years and a lot of other things, got into a pattern of thought, naturally so, of victim, blaming, arguing, conspiracy theory, a whole number of things that you've heard if you had friends from that region. Again, my instinct about this is, yes, that is a tradition, but my instinct is now is the moment, as all these kids are being educated, that it's time to hand over this issue, and intellectual leadership will start with you.
Yes, we have only 20 minutes, so I will pick three questions, and we answer quickly, then I pass your question, Shadi. So one question is, why are Muslim majority nations not taking Middle East and North African refugees? They are. Turkey has 3 million. Many of Syrians are in Lebanon, in the region, obviously.
In Doha.
Yeah. There is also in the Gulf countries, and also North Africa. In the people coming from the Sahel are stopping before in North Africa. But obviously, people coming not only for refugees, but for economic reasons, they want to go to Europe because of the future development they can have in their lives. But yes, they are taking, and this is. Why European Union did the agreement of $3 billion, you keep the 3 million refugees and we close eyes on your democratic troubles. The other question is, the so-called West, why do we continue to define the West identify with the USA. There are many diversities inside the US. Yes, it's true, but there is obviously the North Atlantic alliances since the Second World War is the strongest alliances. There are democratic values we are sharing, but there are diversities. For example, with Iran, this morning we spoke about ISIS. We did the European Union, we pushed for an agreement, and US accepted that, China, Russia, that agreement is a multi-party agreement. Now the new administration wants to pull out. Well, there are different visions in European Union. So there are divisions, obviously, in the so-called West, but for many elements we are together. And finally, is this, do you think America's the Middle East relationship will be affected by Trump? Yes, again, as I said, obviously, with the bomb in Afghanistan, we cannot bomb ideologies like ISIS. We spoke this morning about ISIS. We need a long-term investment in developing economic and political integration of these areas. We, as the European Union, or even Italy, we proposed...
I don't agree with that.
Yes, then you can answer then another point, but... obviously, for example, they see as Iran as the evil. Well, one thing is the regime, one thing is the people. There are self-fulfilling prophecies. If we keep talking about this is my enemy, it will become my enemy, I will escalate the relationship. Iran has 100 years of democratic values. They had a constitutional movement in 1906, like Turkey, and they had democracy for decades. Then we arrive, we impose with the military coup, obviously, the Shah, and then as a reaction we have the revolution with democratic values, strong democratic values, Ari Shariati, hijacked by the Ayatollah regime, okay? But the population is one thing, the regime is another thing, the civilization is another thing, 5,000 years, the quantity of the people, the contribution they give economically, and et cetera, et cetera. So, obviously, the Middle East is very complex, and we cannot say we just send 59 Tomahawk missiles to Iraq, and then the Fox Fox journalist said, "You mean to Syria?" "Yes, yeah, we send to Syria." That's the level of the presidency here. They don't know where to send the missiles. check on YouTube, Fox News.
So the only difference I have, and I'm trying to address how we phrase these things. I'm trying to change our own orientation to this question. And just try that in your mind. If you took out your instinct to say we're going to fix their problems, we're going to help their problems, we're going to give them economic development, we're going to provide all this assistance, I want to just put that aside.
Yeah, we agree.
Not helping, you know, like, oh, are you there in Saudi Arabia to help Saudi women? No. I'm there to respect them or wish them well. This is their region, this is their religion, and these are their children. This is a profound internal question from the way Islam is practiced in Indonesia and Malaysia and the way it's practiced in Saudi. This is a family discussion with different members of the family doing different things. So it's hard for us to break this. We all, you know, we're going to send an NGO in to help them. They deserve respect for how hard this is.
Yes, thank you, Maurizio, and also Janet. I think how to put it this way, the confrontation, you know, of Islam and West has been going on because we perpetuate it, because many of the countries wanted to see like that. And now there are other evils such as North Korea, and Iran, obviously, Assad. And more and more we put ourselves into this context, and this will forever stay in our thinking how to defeat. Let's think about understanding instead of defeat. Because to me, if you have an understanding, then the other side also will understand you. It's very simple, just like in the role of dialogue. But we tend not to believe with this anymore. We tend to believe to, for example, producing verbal abuse statement towards one community. You know, the Muslim ban recently, for example, I know many maybe don't think that this is a Muslim ban, but some believe that it is Muslim ban, of the six or seven countries on the list. And many of these countries are not the people who bombed World Trade Center on 9/11. And although we question this, why is this sixth country? Those who are bombing the World Trade Center are mostly Saudi, am I correct? Saudi
15 of the 19.
Yes. Citizens.
Allies.
That is again put the question. So if they're going to put, for example, my country soon, because we are the largest Muslim country in the world, this will be a disaster. Because more and more we cannot introduce the kind of moderate Islam that we have been practicing since hundreds of years. More and more people have judgment and think of good and bad. And this is very dangerous, I think, for the future, not only for American, but also for global society. And I think this type of understanding needs to be built by rational dialogue. Also, we cannot rely on government so much, in particular with this administration, but I do still count the American people, the heart, the generosity, the values that you carry. I mean, I learned so much of these Western values that I embedded with me, and there's nothing wrong with that, you know. So these are some of the elements that we should push together. I do believe that if we create a positive narrative of Islam, these people wouldn't be even popular, you know, because they are popular now. They're going on YouTube, this ISIS, and watching all this killing in Syria and Palestine, and use that as a threat against a non-Muslim. This is not true, and this is not Islam. If you kill one person in Islam, you kill the whole humanity. This is what we believe in Islam. So that's why I never think ISIS are Muslim.
Which is why there's a need for Islamic leadership on the question. What she just said. Right? This is why there's a need for Islamic, the elders, the business leaders, the scholars, the moms and dads have to take on this question. We say this. It is not a resolved issue in Islam. It's not a resolved issue. And one of the key questions, and again, as you can contradict me about this because it's my perception as a non-Muslim, the threat of declaring someone in debate, if two Muslims are talking, or a group, and the threat of saying you are un-Islamic, apostasy, a non-believer, that threat comes, especially in a country like, in countries in the Gulf, comes with the potential of death. That is an inhibition to debate. It's a powerful question in Pakistan. This is a powerful issue in Pakistan, this debate over this question, right? And in Afghanistan, and I think in your country as well. It's a debate right now. People are discussing this question. But I just want to say that I am in profound, again, sensitivity to how hard these questions are.
I have to read the questions, but yeah, these two questions I will read. Yeah, read yours, give her more. But okay, are we still fighting the Crusades? No. That time it was a little bit different. More related, obviously, it was related with the evangelization and the changing of this. Who is the owner of the real monotheistic Abrahamic religion? That's why earlier I said in Berlin we are building one temple. We should build in Istanbul, in Riyadh, one temple, temple one, one entrance and three exit. And the other thing I want to say is today is for sphere of influences, economic, political sphere of influences. We know the area is between Africa, Asia and Europe is the crucial areas because it's a passage of not only resources but populations, trade. And that's why the Cold War is again there because we are fighting the spheres of influences between Russia and the Europe or the US. Thoughts: why America loves Rumi and fears Iran? Well, this room is from Konya. We went, all of us, I think. Yes, I know, you said that. To see the beautiful spiritual environment there. He's coming originally from Iran, from he lived in Afghanistan. So here, as we said earlier, there is a need of spirituality. That's why we are in the post-secular world. Spirituality in the sense of community belonging, of not only alienation of our modern individualistic societies. So there is the love, the need of this contact, but then the problem is politically we fear someone that is stable and growing and is alternative to our alliances in the Middle East. That's why we fear the regime of Iran.
I've got two quick questions. One is, can the media do anything about the images issue? And again, I go back to the issue in Saudi. If they opened up their country, open the door. Let people in, let you all visit. Come to your own interaction with Saudi. Saudis are very hospitable. They will invite you over for dinner. They're very generous. I mean, I just tell you one story. When I would introduce myself to people, I would mention in passing that I'm an only child. And Saudi women would come up to me and hug me because they realized I was a disabled person. Because I had no sisters to guide me and no brothers to protect me. And all of a sudden, I thought, they're right. But Saudis became my sisters, right? They're very warm and generous. So this image, and Saudis will complain about this constantly, that they're misperceived in the media. Open the door. The second question, I think, is about this going back and forth between Asian or Indonesia, Malaysia, and Saudi. Does Saudi have more influence because of oil? Well, Indonesia has oil. But I don't think it's really that question about our dependence. We're independent now. I do think, and I would hope to see, how wonderful it would be if Malaysia and Indonesia convened a Congress, a conference, and invited intellectual leaders across the Muslim world to debate issues on their agenda, whatever those issues may be. I'm not going to dictate this. But start the ferment, start the intellectual engagement, encourage the next generation, which I think is what you're talking about. The next generation is a time to step up to the plate. And I would love it if Indonesia took the lead.
I think for Indonesia took the lead, we might need some time. Just like when we think Bernie Sanders can't be president. Something like that. So. Recently there was a visit by King Salman of Saudi Arabia, and guess where he chose a place to visit? Bali, the Hindu state in Indonesia.
Beautiful,
he came
beautiful.
With 1,500 luggages, 15 boys, masseuse, chef, maids, everything, pots and pans. He traveled like in the old days, but he traveled with jets and, you couldn't believe the whole Indonesia. We were watching on TV. The airport was closed a day before even he arrived. Red carpet, everything. This is King Salman. First, it's the guiding of the two holy mosques that Muslims believe. And why did he choose Bali as a visit? Because Bali, since you are closing down here because of the not accepting Muslim people to come to America, many Arabs or any other Muslim faith now going to Indonesia. So economically we are gaining. And that he arrived when the Indonesian asked them to watch the Bali dance. You know the Bali dance, the women are wearing a little bit of sexy, And he watched it for 8 minutes. And to me that is already showing that he kind of accept the different, but it might take time, So I think King Salman wants to prove also to the world. And then on top of that, he was invited by the Indonesian President Jokowi to address the World Peace Forum, the forum of different religions. He sat next to priests and Hindu, unbelievable. You should watch that on TV, on the news. He sat with all different faith in Jakarta. So I think he knows. at some point, this strict religious practice undermining the spirituality, this cannot go on. Because at the end of the day, what matters about you is your spirituality.
Right.
And he realized that. I think by going to Bali, not asking to move all the gods, you know, Bali have different gods, many, many of gods, you know, in the Hindu culture. And he doesn't say anything, yet he embraced the diversity. He stayed for 8 days, and I tell you, Bali make a lot of money. And all the hotels are fully booked since 1 month before. So this is just an example I want to tell you, that they are also thinking of changing. The women cannot drive now, but maybe they will soon. I do believe they will soon can drive. We don't have problem of driving. We can drive, you know, even there are women, many women pilots in Indonesia. So I do understand that many of these questions relate to radical Islamist organization. Yes, that's true. I have no doubt about that. But this is also geared up because of political failure. The government, most of these governments, whichever countries are now dealing with terrorism, can't deal with their own people.
That's a good point.
This authoritarian regime that has been in power for 30, 40 years don't know how to deal with democracy, don't know how to deliver development to their people. If they build road and infrastructure, that's also giving access for military. And this is the kind of thinking in the 50s and 60s of most Arab leaders, from Saddam Hussein, Muammar Gaddafi, Hosni Mubarak, and so forth. So this kind of radicalization is, in my part of the world, in Southeast Asia, mostly because of either they're studying in Saudi Arabia, and then they come back, they bring, oh, what you're doing is wrong. This is not
judgmental.
Right. Judgmental. Also in Pakistan, it was a very moderate country, India too, but now it's shifting a little bit. It become a little bit like Saudi, I would say, the practices and everything. So they have the money, and they're putting this money for peace in Vienna. Now, I don't think these Austrian people are doing a great job, because they should put at least in Muslim country. Why don't they have an office in Indonesia or Istanbul? This is the first thing they should do. So I don't say there is no radicalization. There are many, in fact, in particular, giving money, funding to the madrasas, the Orthodox Islamic teaching. They only focus on rituals, very less spirituality. And this is what we have to maintain. And I do believe if we keep moving with our positive narrative, we can really make sure these people are irrelevant. We can fight them with Facebook, because you know what? ISIS put up their status 50 times a day. We can't do that. They're very, very expert. That's what ISIS is doing. They've been promoting their struggle through YouTube, Facebook, all the social media, all the Western product they're using to encourage young people. And many of these ISIS fighters coming from Western Europe, they're not coming from small village in India. They're not coming from squad in Pakistan. Well, some, but not many. But in fact, from countries like Holland and Germany. They're the largest producers of ISIS fighters. Now think about, why is this happening? How come the largest Muslim country like Indonesia don't produce ISIS fighters or jihadists? So I think we should reflect on this.
Let me just mention a quick thing. You know, all of us as humans are aware of sometimes our goals and our reality of life. One of the first values I learned in Islam when I was in Saudi Arabia was the value of humility and humbleness. Right? So the Prophet himself, as well as Jesus in the Christian tradition, were humble people born in a manger, poor farmer, the Prophet's case, an orphan. So when I hear about how King Salman traveled to Indonesia, and I'm reminded of that value in Islam of humility and humbleness, there is a lot for Muslims to talk to each other about.
Yeah. I wanted to applaud you too. Anyway, so
we're all
yes,
Europe.
Okay, we said already about Europe, the integration. Yeah, last minute, so I will do the close remark. I want to say this. Which, yeah, we cannot answer all the questions, but which Muslim minority country is most welcoming to the faith and why? Well, I think about Europe, I will talk about Italy. The question is, which one Muslim minority country is most welcoming in the faith and why?
Welcoming.
We have a Muslim minority. I would say Italy. Let me say, brag a little bit more country. When Iran arrived, when, you know, the president of Iran arrived, we covered the statues for respect and of the sensibilities. And then France said that you are betraying our values of democracy, freedom, etc., etc. We say we are a peninsula. We had exchange of trade, as Shadia said, for hundreds and thousands of years with Arabs and with Muslims. And we have also Vatican, and we are very much interested in spirituality and in spiritual values. So there are many reasons why ISIS didn't attack us, among which most important is the fact that we don't have military intervention in the area. But the other reason is that the spirituality we value. And in the Muslim world, I'm happy that we can say the Christian, the Muslim, and the Jewish, sooner or later, will have to build in Jerusalem or in Istanbul or in Cordoba these kind of temples in which we pray the same God and we start. And I'm happy also about being the only man here in the panel, because women, talking about Islam, women are the majority here, and that's a very good thing.
Answer
last question on hijab.
We have 1 minute.
Yes, there are many cards asking about hijab, so I felt like, just if you just bear with me for 30 seconds. I don't feel that this is an oppression. I felt that this is a closeness to God, my submission, and modesty. Let's put it this way. If I want to be seen as Shadia, as myself, not as someone who can be described as a, you know, in this way. I think there is the concept of modesty came when not only in Islam, but also in Christianity and also in Judaism. And many of my these two friends who lives also in Palestine and other parts of Muslim country, they are also covering their hair. So Muslim are not the only one. However, it's obvious now because many Muslim women are wearing, but it is not, no one is asking me to do this. It is not an oppression by my father or my husband or whoever, but it's simply I want to wear it because I feel comfortable and because of my modesty. Thank you.
One interesting question, because Saudi girls have also talked to me about this, is the difference between the expression of modesty is interpreted in practice, and we've been talking, the girls and I have been talking about the expression of modesty in your action. So can you express modesty in the way you are, in addition to or aside from how you look? So just think about value and practice.
Thank you.
Let's give our panelists a round of applause.